Behaves quite differently, though, than Zika virus. But what we are starting to see following an outbreak in Panama of this disease is that there seem to be household factors. So lack of sanitation, for example, appear to be associated with increased risk for having been exposed to this virus. Similarly, having particular agricultural exposures seems to be another risk factor for this particular virus. And what's interesting in this region is that there's been a massive movement of people into the Darien province, which was formerly forested. Now vast swaths are deforested, and they've become pasture land for cattle. And how exactly this is going to play out, we don't understand yet. We're in the process of figuring that out. But I think it's very instructive to understand that West Nile virus, dengue virus, chikungunya, and Zika all actually probably originate from the Central African forests. And subsequent to human contact, as humans venture in and encroach upon that forest, it's possible that the virus and the mosquitoes ultimately adapt to then human cycles. And from there, it's able to spread worldwide. So there are, again, many unknowns in the sequence of events. But I think it's very prudent to take a closer look at the ecological effects the ecological effects that may precipitate further vector-borne illness.
Amy Vitor, we want to thank you for being with us, Assistant Professor of Medicine at University of Florida's Division of Infectious Disease. That does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to you, Gran. We also have job openings, broadcast engineer, director of finance and operations, and director of development. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with our host, Joanne Hardesty. Today's guest is Jason Renault from the Mental Health Association of Oregon. We'll talk about the fatal shooting of 19-year-old Christopher Kalonji by two Clackamas deputies last month and the role the DA should play in answering community questions.
Help us celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Confessional Radio Show with Contessa de la Luna. We have performances by Contessa de la Luna herself, Remy Fasolatido, Mike Crenshaw, and many more. We have plenty of audience participation, including Human Shadow Puppet Theater, Animal Impersonation Contests, and prizes. And don't miss our David Bowie Kazoo Tribute. All that and more, Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Tickets are $10 for an entire night of music, mayhem, laughs, and surprises. All proceeds benefit KBOO Community Radio. Tickets available now in advance at brownpapertickets.com or at the door. Join us Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Portland Bob Marley Birthday Party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom in Portland. The life of Bob Marley will be celebrated with live reggae by Simba Puma and the Roaring Lions, by DJs Reggae Bob and Pablo One from Kingston, Jamaica, and live streaming from Kingston's own Bob Marley Festival. Again, that's the first annual Portland Bob Marley Birthday Party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom at 615 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It's my pleasure to have in the studio with me, Jason Renault. He's with the Mental Health Association of Portland. I keep saying Oregon, but Steve corrected me this morning. It's actually Portland.
Those are our sisters down in covering the whole state.
Covering the whole state. Yes, yes, yes. Well, you have your hands full with just just your own neck of the woods. Also, you are a producer of the film Alien Boy, which told the tragic story of James Chassie and his death at the hands of Multnomah County and Portland Police. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Joanne.
Unfortunately, we're talking about another death at the hands of police in the city of Portland today. And what we know is that on January 29th, at approximately 8 o'clock in the morning, a family member called the Clackamas County Sheriff to report that there was a 19-year-old young man, pointing a rifle at family members. And so the police came out. I understand that the crisis response team came out. They also had mental health professionals were at the scene. They were there for a very long period of time. But ultimately, the 19-year-old was shot and killed. And they're not saying how he was shot and killed just yet. But we do know that the police shot into the location. We do know that they sent a kind of a bomb that they blasted in the front door. So those are some of the things that we know, but there's so many things that we don't know, right? I think the big question is, if you bought crisis negotiators, why didn't we let that process happen? That's one of the first questions that pops into my head. And of course, the question is, what information has the DA released to the public? And so far, there's been very scant information.
Well, that's all correct. We don't know much about this case. It's just beginning, and we're hoping that the reporting gets better.
Yes,
and that more media takes a look at this and starts asking questions of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department and John Foote, the Clackamas County District Attorney.
Right, and sometimes, at least in Multnomah County, we have been able to get the district attorney to hold a public inquest, as well as to release the transcripts of the grand jury testimony. Do you know where that process is right now?
Well, that's a very interesting thing that's happening here in Multnomah County. Has been happening for several years. Mm-hmm. First Mike Schrunk, and now District Attorney Rod Underhill has continued to release the police investigations in cases of police use of force where lethal force was used. And those are put on the district attorney's website. And they answer with great clarity so many questions the community has. Mm-hmm. These are long documents, 300 and 400 pages long. They're very comprehensive, where the police go and interview all the witnesses and the officers involved. They do the forensic analysis, and we greatly appreciate District Attorney Underhill doing this, and we're hoping that Clackamas County and other Oregon counties get to do this at some point.
Right. Well, it sounds like we may need to go to the legislature and just kind of mandate that in these kind of situations it becomes automatic. Because, I mean, just like in Multnomah County, we are left to the goodwill of whoever the DA happens to be, right? We're just fortunate that Underhill has continued the practice that Mike Schrunk started. I guess my biggest concern is that I spend a lot of time focused on Portland Police and how Portland Police engages with community members who are suffering from mental health issues. But it's apparent to me that policing in general needs to look at how they engage with people with mental health issues or people perceived to have mental health problems. And in this particular case, it's ironic because it's a lot like Erin Campbell's case and it's a lot like other cases that we could mention. A family member called because they're in distress because there's a situation happening that they can't handle. It looks like calls were made to the right people. But again, it's at some point, one of the articles that I read said that the mental health professionals were told to stand down, that SWAT was going to take over the action. And so as a community member, I would want to know if you're dealing with someone with mental health issues, you would think that they would have control of the situation, right? You called me in because I'm the mental health professional. And so I think that that's another question that the DA should be able to answer for the public.
Let's say this young man's name. He's Christopher Kalongji.
Kalongji, yes.
He went to North Clackamas High School. He was 19 years old. He lived in Oak Grove for about 10 years with his mother and father. He did have one encounter with the police back in October of 2015 where he called 911. The officers came to wherever he was, and they found that what he called for was immaterial. So they cited him with misdemeanors for both misuse of 911 and misuse of their time. These are minor charges, but charges we often see for people who are in a mental health crisis who are trying to ask for help from 911.
Right.
Chris's parents are immigrants to the United States, and Chris is an African-American person. So this case does look a lot like Erin Campbell, where a family member sought help from 911. The police responded. But where we learn a great deal in the Portland community and the Portland Police Accountability Committee, we learned a great deal from the Erin Campbell case. It appears that the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department did not.
I agree with you there. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. There will be a woman calling in a bit later in the program who I've been in Facebook communication with, who actually lives at the apartment complex and actually recorded the standoff that was taking place. And so she's going to be calling to share that information. What I didn't ask her is if she was interviewed by the police and if the district attorney had a copy of her evidence. But those are some of the questions I will ask her when she calls in later. So I appreciate the fact that you went because this is what you normally do. You hear about a tragedy and you actually went to try to talk to the family and try to figure out how you could be supportive of their efforts.
That's right. We do try to reach out to each family after these cases to provide them with what we know and what the other families that proceeded ahead of them have learned and taught us. It is a very difficult time. Each family is different, but if we have any resource that they can make use of, we're glad to talk to them about that.
I think that's wonderful. I also reached out to Casey Jama, and he was unfamiliar with the family, but he's also going to try to reach out to them and see if he can offer some assistance. I think this case highlights that throughout Oregon, actually throughout the nation, we should be rethinking policing in a way that is significant. And what an ideal time we have here in Oregon as we're starting, well, here in Portland, as we're starting the budget process, we're already seeing the normal, whenever you say across the board 5% cut, what you normally see on the cutting board are, of course, programs that the public desperately supports and the public definitely wants to see going. For anybody who's been involved in the budgeting process in the city of Portland or at the state level, what you know is that this is what normally happens is you get presented this budget that's absolutely stupid and insane and nobody would support it even on a bad day. But it's a way to protect, quite frankly, the things that maybe Portland Police should not be doing. I continue to say they should not be in the social service industry. They need to get back to policing. They should not be deciding who gets housing, who gets treatment that's out of their lane. They should not be doing that. They should not be in the police, and police should not be in the public schools, yet they are in our public school systems. But those are the things that are on the chopping block as far as the police bureau's budget is concerned. $8 million budget cut, but in the traffic division. And so things you know they're not going to cut, but they're on the chopping block. Now is a great time to be thinking about what do we want policing to look like in the city of Portland. We have about 70 officers that are ready to retire. We've got about 50 open positions. It takes us forever to hire a Portland police officer. And so I think this is an ideal time for the community to start looking at what does policing really need to look like in Portland and as compared to what we have today, right? Because it doesn't make sense to just add people into a dysfunctional system without figuring out what is the system that makes sense for community policing today.
And I think we've done a good job in Portland in putting our foot in the door of that conversation. Yes. And starting to talk to the police bureau about what they should look like in the future. The mixing and melding of police and social services gets really complicated when you get into suburban and rural communities where you don't have the level of professionalism and the level of training that we do have here in Portland. But what we've learned here in Portland about this confluence of police and mental illness and what we've learned nationally around the issues of race and police very slowly is moving into the rural community. So we're hoping that in this case that the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department takes the opportunity to learn from this case and not have this happen again, because the numbers of lethal police events have remain constant in Portland.
Right.
In the outlying communities, they're actually going up.
Really? Now, I was certainly unaware of that. If you're just joining the conversation, I'm talking to Jason Renault with the Mental Health Association of Portland. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. It's interesting because I think you're right. I think Clackamas, I think when I think about Gresham Police, when I think about Fairview, I think about these tiny police departments. It certainly makes you wonder, especially with the movement of people of color into these outlying suburban areas, whether or not we're going to be seeing many more of these kind of incidents because the police and the community are really, quite frankly, unprepared for the influx of people of color in those communities.
Right. What's the diversity plan for the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department or the Fairview Police Department? They're just never going to be able to keep up with the popular culture, the current community. They're always going to be lagging behind because of this long career experience of police officers.
Right, that's true. And again, we keep saying that we need people, like real people like you and me, at the academy training police officers on what a community police officer should be. That's something that we still haven't been able to get Portland to embrace. I understand that we now have limited scenario role plays that take place with people from the mental health community in the training curriculum, but very limited. and not as intense as you and I would like to see and the training. Because I think, how are you going to be a community police officer if you're not being trained or getting information from the community about what the community norms are, how the community likes to engage with law enforcement, and what role the community and the police play in keeping the community safe?
Yeah, the Portland police have not been transparent about their training around mental illness. We're really unknowing about what they do and who does it there. And quite skeptical that it's useful.
And they have a mental health advisory, actually they have a training advisory committee that has offered training once as far as the DOJ's review of the work of that committee. And it's a really, and the DOJ says that they're actually incompetent. They don't actually understand who they report to, what their role is, why they exist, and it doesn't seem like the police bureau has done a sufficient job of actually reinvigorating that particular committee. But I mean, there are just so many, which was my challenge under the former police chief, is because before he left, he put together all these advisory committees to make sure that that he had that the committees functioned in a way that he wanted them to function, as compared to what would be most useful for reform.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to get back to this young man, because, as you said, families respond differently after a tragedy like this. I know that we just recently celebrated the life of Erin Campbell after 6 years of 6 years after his death at the hands of Portland Police. And what struck me by that memorial is that Erin Campbell's mother now is a much more forceful speaker about her experience and her family's experience suffering intimidation at the hand of Portland police after they had killed her son. And she spoke about the police officers actually knowing her son prior to the interaction that ended with his death. And I know from Kendra James' mom, it took Kendra James' mom 10 years to be able to publicly talk about Kendra James and what happened and how that's impacted their family. And so Marva, it's wonderful to see that she's finding her voice and she's unafraid to use her voice in seeking justice for her son still.
Well, these parents and survivors are such important advocates for other families to hear, to say, I'm not alone.
Yes.
There's other people who have survived this experience, because you feel like your world has been turned upside down.
Yes.
Not the person killed, but right. The family members who survived this day after day.
That's right.
So having some outside help, someone who speaks up and speaks out, very valuable.
Absolutely true. And what you and I have learned over the years is that family members do that at different times, right?
That's
they're
right.
ready at different times. And sometimes they're just grateful that other people are speaking up on their behalf until they're ready to find their voice. I certainly know with Keith Notice, his dad, Fred Bryant, the day after his son was killed, he was out advocating for justice for his son. He was ready. He didn't know what he needed to do, but he knew he needed to advocate for his son. And so I do want to offer the family to let them know that there are organizations like the Mental Health Association of Portland, Portland Cop Watch, NAACP, organizations that will work with the family whenever they want in a way that's comfortable for them, because I think that is the key. And so again, I'm talking to Jason Renault. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We're getting ready for this mayoral race because in Portland there's going to be a new mayor. Which means that there's going to be a new police commissioner.
That's right.
Which means that, and there will be a new contract. So, you know, next year we'll have a new police commissioner. And at the same time, 2017 will be the contract for Portland Police Association will be up again. And when our current police commissioner came in, he came in under the platform as he was going to fix what was broken in Portland Police. And I find it kind of ironic because he came in also at the exact same time that the contract was up for renewal. And I think police commissioners don't know what they don't know until they're police commissioners, because 6 months later there was a contract that didn't deal with some real basic issues like getting away with doing away with the 48-hour rule, being able to compel testimony when a police officer used deadly force. There are just so many basic things that should have been a given because of the Department of Justice investigation, because of everything that had been happening with Portland Police up until that point. And I was thoroughly disappointed when the new contract was signed and these things still were not addressed. And I thought, if you can't fix it when the Department of Justice is breathing down your neck, when can you fix it?
Well, the community pressure has not been there, frankly. And the media has not been there. And the city's the interest of the city in the mind of the mayor, the police commissioner, has not been there. This is something to be avoided, if at all possible, if you're
like
a politician.
Like the plague.
Right. So it requires the community. And this is why we wrote a few weeks ago in Street Roots newspaper an article about that the police union contract, that these mayoral candidates need to get on record now about being involved with that police union contract, reviewing it themselves,
being in
those meetings, knowing what's going on, and being accountable to the community. Because we come to these microphones over and over saying something must be done. What must be done must be the change in this contract. And we can march in the streets all day.
Right.
But as long as that contract holds, the arbitrator will continue to hold that the contract is substantial and put those officers like Ron Frashar back on the job.
Yes, yes. And, of course, the community is very aware that we're trying to still get information about where Frashar is. Is he in the academy again? Because he was off work for 6 years,
mm-hmm.
So he has to go back through the academy. Is it the full academy or is it a condensed academy? And bottom line, is he actually not working with the public? Because nobody I know wants to see Frashar show up on their doorstep for any call at all. But you're right, it is the pressure that the community must put on people to be as specific as possible. The arbitrator is another one of those that has to disappear from the next contract, right? If a employer cannot fire an employee, no matter who you are, that's a problem. And so the 48-hour rule. And the interesting thing is whether it's the Department of Justice, whether it's the overpaid consultants, the OIR group, everybody has for the last decade told them the 48-hour rule has to go and the arbitration system makes no sense.
Joanne, explain the 48-hour rule.
So the 48-hour rule means that if a police officer is involved in a deadly force use of a deadly use of force case, that they have 48 hours before they have to actually give a statement as to what happened. Unlike you or I, which is if the police showed up and they asked us what happened, we're expected to tell them what happened right then and there. The reason for that is it is in the contract. And it's in the contract because the police allege that police are so traumatized after they've been involved in a shooting, they need those 2 days to get their thoughts together before an official statement is given.
Now, there's a nuance to this. If the officer wants to give testimony, that 48-hour rule, how does that work?
An officer could voluntarily give information, but no officer voluntarily gives information before that 48-hour time period is up. It's supposed to happen now with the Department of Justice because they're required to do these after-action reports, but those still are required to be done within 48 hours.
And if an officer gives a testimony,
yes,
willingly, do they receive some sort of immunity?
Yes, they do. The reason is that, right, if a officer is compelled to testify, the officer has automatic immunity right? And so nothing that that officer says could be used against them if, in fact, they were going to be prosecuted. And, of course, the union falls back on that. But the bottom line is that we've never, ever in the history of Portland Police charged an officer with a criminal, with a crime for killing a community member. We just never, ever, ever done that. And so to say we can't talk to him for 48 hours because we don't want the immunity to kick in is just ludicrous. And so we have several callers on the line, and we're going to go to the phone line in just a sec. As soon as I think we're going to go to the phone line in just a sec. So the 48-hour rule has been one of those kind of things that showed up in the contract that the city acts like they have no idea how it got there. Clearly there was a negotiation that happened way back when, where city leaders actually affirmed and approved this contract, these mechanisms in the contract. And so for them to imply that somehow they don't know how they got there is crazy. And in last contract talk, the 48-hour rule, interestingly, after the negotiations, Charlie Hales had a meeting with AMA steering committee, and he brings in a whole bunch of lawyers, and he talks about how hard fought the negotiations were for the police contract, and he goes through this whole list of, we did this, we did that, we did that. When he was done, I was like, well, what about the 48-hour rule? Oh, well, they would never give that up. And so that told me it was never on the table. Now, how do you negotiate something that's not even on the table? And if you can't do that when the DOJ is looking, breathing down your neck, when can you do it? Most people would have gone into that negotiation saying, okay, the 48-hour rule is gone. What else do you got? Now let's negotiate, because that's got to go as per the DOJ, as per the OIR, which is the independent group that reviews shootings, deaths in custody by Portland police officers. Their third report was released last week. And some of the information, if you go back and look at the other two reports, recommendations are consistent throughout. Mm-hmm. Do away with the 48-hour rule. You got to fix this broken arbitration system. You have police officers who have are buying into a premise that of suicide by cop. And so we hear that periodically. Well, we had to shoot them because, you know, they were trying to commit suicide. And so we had to shoot them. The OIR group even said that that Portland police officers need to get away from that narrative where they are assuming that somebody with a mental health issue, the only outcome is going to be the death of that individual.
Yeah, I think what they don't realize is that people are laughing at them when they use that commentary. That's just ridiculous.
Of course, the general public knows that that's just insane, but the narrative continues to be the public narrative because the police are the only ones, right, who get to tell the story.
So it sounds like a leadership issue, Joanne.
Yes, it does. But that's another question. We're going to go to the phone line. We have several callers on the line. Good morning. Good morning, Don. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Joanne. This is Don.
Hey, Don. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, you know, if the cops, if you're involved in a shooting and you're one of the people did it,
right?
And they come up and ask you, we want you to tell us what happened, and you say, listen, I need 48 hours. You're going to jail. They're going to cuff you and take you away. So right there, it's already wrong. Also, the other thing is, you're talking about the union. This union has to go, and here's a couple reasons. One is, you know, they're government employees. And so they automatically have a higher level of protection than anybody else. And the second is they have the power to take life. And I just don't think any government agency or employee who can take a life should be have a union, because it should be a really high standard of behavior. And that's the problem with this union. And like I told you before, they put on those T-shirts saying, I am Chris Humphrey. Now, they were still investigating Humphrey, both here at Internal Affairs and the feds. And he had just assaulted that girl, and that's what they claim why they did it. They were trying to defend him for that. But the impression was, for those of us with disabilities out here, as we're kind of hearing these 600 thugs marching through the street, you know, going like, what the hell? How can the hell can they do this while they're still investigating this guy for killing James Chassis? Right. It was so pathetic. The union printed those T-shirts. They paid for them. As far as I'm concerned, right there, they lost the right by interfering with an investigation at the state and federal level. They lost the right. They should be decertified. And the last thing I want to say is, so my feeling is the union has to go. And the fact that this mayor brought in someone from Chicago to oversee all this is just proves it's a huge leadership problem. But listen, Joan, I want to mention something about last week. That lady Jessica Campbell, you know, she kept giggling and laughing during that whole interview. I counted about 12 times. And it's really, I don't want to be politically incorrect, but it just seems like able-bodied white women do not get it, what's happening to those of us with disabilities, to people of color, to homeless people. They're out here kind of making jokes about stuff. I listen all the time saying, how snarky can you, how can you say this? We're dying out here on the street. And so I think that's another part of this problem. And I feel like Jessica Campbell was a little insincere, because that guy should never have been executed like that. I feel like maybe he's get flipping him the bird. This is Oregon. We won the right to flip the cops the bird in the court. And maybe that's what he's doing, getting ready to flip him the bird. Who knows? But he didn't pull the gun out. They had so many people, they could have took him out when they wanted. And all these things that they're doing to us sends a message to us that we're totally disposable. So that's the problem that I have in terms of mental health.
I appreciate you sharing, but let me just say, I just think Jessica has that nervous laugh. You know, sometimes, you know, we laugh instead of crying. So I wouldn't take that. I mean, I know Jessica, and I know that her heart's in the right place. She's been organizing progressive causes in very rural communities for a long time. So
I guess she would have been a little more sympathetic to a person who had died. Now, politically, a lot of us don't agree with him. I'm 1/8 Native American. I thought he was kind of disrespectful what they were doing. And so I guess I wish she would have been a little more sympathetic to a person who's now not alive anymore. And I don't care who it is. Anybody's life goes away, whether it's a 3-year-old boy that drowned coming over in the river on that boat, you know, from Syria.
Right.
And Charlie Hebdo did a cartoon that said, well, at least he won't grow up to be a Syrian groper. So that's what we got in this world. We got to fix that problem. So thank you, guys.
Thank you. Appreciate your call. Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. comments?
About nervous giggling? Maybe after the show.
Yeah, right. We'll do that. Right. I'm not doing nervous giggling. Am I? No. One of the things that Don talked about is the gentleman that was killed with the occupation that's been taking place for over a month now in Burns. I know that there was a video that for the first time, I don't think I've ever heard of the FBI releasing a video like within 24 hours of someone being killed by them to the public. And
well, this is the power of scrutiny. This is the power of the community watching. And even though it was certainly sort of a national perspective and not a local perspective, they certainly have this material to put out for it very quickly. I do think this case, and I did watch the video, is an accurate representation of suicide by cop.
Say that again?
Well, this man said, I'm never going to go to jail. They're going to have to kill me.
Right.
And then when presented with police force, ran out at them and proceeded to pull a gun. He was trying to get himself killed by police to prove a point to become a martyr.
So I saw the video as well, and I do think you're right. I think he was going for his weapon. His weapon was fully loaded, and this is a group of people who've been fully armed since they showed up in Oregon. So I don't know how you would not have expected, especially after ditching the roadblock and trying to get away and then jumping out of the car coming towards the deputy. So could it have ended differently? I mean, if you value human life, then I think that you do everything possible to make sure that the least amount of harm was done. And so I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not going to try to second guess the deputies that were there.
Sorry for them. That's a bad job.
Well, But I'm more sorry for the community that's been under siege for the last month, where people can't go to work, they can't go to their churches, they can't go to school, they're stuck in their houses because they have armed people. I mean, I tell you, as a black woman in America, if I was in a community with a bunch of armed white men walking around, there's no way in heck I'd feel safe. And so I put myself in those people's shoes and think, who are we supposed to protect, right? I mean, we've got law enforcement there, but who are they protecting? And what is their role? That's the bigger question, I think. Boy, have we gotten off track.
Well, Joanne, let's talk a little bit about the family of Chris Kalonji and what could they have done differently to perhaps not anticipate this event. And you and I have talked about this before here and privately about what can families do in a mental health crisis when they're thinking of calling police.
Right.
And I want to say that the thing to do is, unless there is really an imminent danger where violence is being threatened. And in the case of Chris Kalonji, the family called because he was pointing a gun at them. So this may not have been that situation, and it's very hard to second guess these situations just having read through the media. But what we have both in Clackamas County, Multnomah County, and in Washington County are 24-hour crisis lines staffed by mental health professionals who can talk to you before the crisis becomes super dangerous.
Right, before it
escalates. Before you need the police.
Right.
I really urge family members to make use of these hotlines. The Clackamas County Crisis Line is 503-655-8585. And the Multnomah County Crisis Line is 503-988-4888. There's also a crisis line for Clark County, Washington. All these numbers are available. You just Google them. They're easy to find. They're all on our website. And make use of them before the crisis reaches a boiling point.
That's exactly true. There's also an urgent walk-in clinic at 4212 Southeast Division Street that's open from 7 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. 7 days a week.
That's right, and that's in Portland. And if you're in Clackamas County,
but if you're in Clackamas,
there's the Centerstone Clinic on 82nd Avenue is also available for you. Most hours, 10 o'clock in the morning till 8 in the evening, usually. And if you get to that crisis line, they can help you to get to the Centerstone Clinic, and you can just drop in. You don't need insurance. You don't even need to say, I'm a person with a mental illness. You just say, I'm problems, I'm confused, I'm scared, I need some help. Or I have a family member who has problems and confused. Now, if you're a parent of a teenager and you're concerned about their mental illness, the number one thing to do is talk to their doctor about your child and tell them the symptoms and have them help you to guide you into getting treatment or not getting treatment. Teenagers, I got one. Everybody, people have them. They are around and they are a problem. And just their normal behavior looks crazy a lot of the time.
That's right.
How do you know the difference between, say, a little pot smoking on the side or a marijuana addiction?
Right.
The doctor knows. What do you do if the marijuana is a problem? The doctor knows. So make use of your primary care physician.
Excellent, excellent advice. And I'm on Multnomah County's website, and they have crisis flyers and about 20 different languages. And so this information is accessible and available in a whole host of languages. We're going to go back to the phone line. On just a sec, I think. Hello, Theodore. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hey, you know, I just heard you guys. I'm going to just say I just lost about 90% of my respect for you because you just basically, you and your cohort here have justified the murder of a guy in Eastern Oregon who was shown to not have a gun in his hand, who had his hands up. And I think you're taking it very lightly.
That's not what I saw in the video.
Absolutely wrong. And the state of Oregon is going to have susceptibility to a Section 1989 civil rights lawsuit.
So that's not what I saw, sir.
Well, the bottom line is you never saw the guy with a gun in his hand.
And moving on. Thank you so much. I think that this mental health crisis information is really key, because I think the more we can send the professionals to really be with people and talk with people before it reaches a crisis level, the better off we're going to be.
And here's what we see over and over again. Families who don't speak English as a first language,
right.
Families of color, families who have economic hardship,
right.
Are less able to access the medical system,
yes.
and procrastinate and worry and keep it at home, keep it quiet. So we're seeing these problems more and more with these communities that are harder for the public health system to penetrate. So really urge, if you know a family who's in crisis, talk to them about accessing medical help.
And plus, I mean, many families are from locations where either the perception of seeking mental health treatment comes with its own stigma, or they don't know that this treatment's available. So, yes, I absolutely agree with that. Do we have another caller? Hello, Rebel. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to tail on what the other guy was saying, just not as aggressive. The police and the FBI are corrupt systemically. It's not just one department or one group or one city. They all work together. The state police work with the FBI. The state police work with the local police, et cetera. What you saw in the video was stripped of audio. It was also, you were giving a storyline narrated by the FBI to cover their actions. And what's really going to come out of all this when all's said and done, which, by the way, there is a lot of streaming and social media that's happening on this that completely counters that mainstream narrative. So if you sound like the mainstream media, you just look ridiculous. So basically what's going to come out of this is that the FBI was firing on that truck as soon as it hit the snowbank, as according to a witness that was in the truck. Lavoie Finicum jumped out of the car to draw fire away from the truck with his hands up.
That is ridiculous.
Let me finish, please. There was a,
but it's ridiculous what you're saying.
Demonstration in Burns. Where the whole crowd, it was on the live stream, the whole crowd was chanting, hands up, don't shoot. When you say that all ranchers are armed redneck thugs.
No one said
who
that.
Who said that?
Well, when they want to kill black people or whatever.
That's not that's on the subject or of merit.
So I'm going to have to move on, because you're not even using the words that we use. Nobody here said anything about all ranchers being redneck. What I said was when a whole bunch of white armed men take over a community, I would be scared. I don't know too many people who wouldn't be scared. And based on my experience in the United States of America, I would be really, really smart to be scared. But again, the conversation, I don't disagree with one thing that both of you said, which is that law enforcement needs to change throughout this country. And whether you're talking local police or whether you're talking county sheriffs or whether you're talking at the state or federal level, I don't disagree with that. I believe that we have a system that has no accountability built into it. And so the only narrative that survives is a police narrative, which is why we do the work that we do to try to help make sure that the community's voice is included in policing, because we're supposed to be a part of that effort. And so on that note, March 10th, at Maranatha, there will be a mayoral forum with candidates who have already raised $5,000 or more for the election. It's going to be at Maranatha Church. The doors will open at 6. There's a Facebook page. There's an events page. So if you're interested and you have some specific questions that you want to make sure that the next police commissioner answers so that we have them on the record before they take office, that would be a great place to come and get those questions answered.
Right, Joanne, it's going to be you and me and Israel Bayer,
yes,
from Street Roots newspaper. We're going to have the top mayoral candidates, and we're going to try to have a conversation with them where it's back and forth, mm-hmm, and where Jules and Ted can talk with each other and you and I can talk with each other and have the audience come and hear about these issues that are important to our community from the social justice perspective. And really, there's going to be a lot of forums. So there's going to be forums on economic equity, which are really important, and on housing issues.
Which I think April 10th is a economic equity mayoral forum that's being hosted by NAMCO, the National Association of Minority Contractors, in partnership with some other organizations. But you're right, there'll be a bazillion mayoral forums between now and the May primary election.
Oh, and that just cuts out the bottom campaigners, and the top two, I think, go on. Is that correct? If they don't get 51%?
If they don't get 50% plus one.
So we could be listening to these guys until November.
Until November,
so
right.
We're going to get a thorough accounting. But let's have a conversation, and let's tone it down a little bit, get off the talking points, and talk these issues through. We're going to talk about homelessness. We're going to talk about police accountability and see what they know. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about mental health and addiction, because the city didn't think it would add a piece of that action. They thought that was all county and state,
yes,
up until the last
few
years.
The DOJ, right.
The DOJ.
Yes, yes. It's absolutely true. And what we have is actually not the Memphis model, right, which is what we were supposedly getting.
Right. The Portland Police adopted the Memphis model of intervention, the CIT program, back in, I guess that's probably 1996 or 97. But after James Chassis, the model was changed significantly, and we think we don't really know what it is because they've never released the curriculum. But it doesn't seem to work very well because we keep having these cases of people with mental illness having force used against them.
Yes.
And lethal force.
And lethal force, yes. Yes. We have another caller. Hello, Catherine. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you. I'm listening to the program, and as always, when people are encouraged, just sort of, and I don't know if it just seems to be that the standard advice is to call the crisis teams. And I live in Washington County, mm-hmm, and I can tell you that in my lived experience, calling the crisis team here was the worst thing I've ever done. It did not help my severely mentally ill son. It ended him up in the Washington County Jail, where he decompensated. He was 18 years old. He spent 361 days before his case was adjudicated. He's now at the Oregon State Hospital. What I have found in the last year and a half is that other people have had similar experiences, because the crisis people do not just come out alone. They bring police. Police take over. If they think that the person needs to be taken care of, they can trump up charges in the course of helping, in quotation marks, these people. Assaults can be made. One man I know of was fleeing a case, and his car hit a sheriff's car, and he was charged with attempted murder of a police officer. Many, many people who are mentally ill are languishing in the Washington County Jail. It has become our de facto hospital here. Mm. I have another loved one who is severely mentally ill, And all I'm told is to call the crisis team, call the crisis team, call the crisis team. And I'm sorry, I could never trust those people again, ever.
Joanne, we've heard these complaints about Washington County Jail, and specifically for years and years. It's a horrible place. I know people who spend a lot of time there in pain and suffering. And there just isn't an alternative. That's my problem. And I'd like to ask the caller, if not the community crisis line, what would you suggest?
I guess the families like mine, we deal with it ourselves because we take these people to hospitals. Hospitals don't seem to give a damn about them. They're turned around, you know. I know that there are fewer civil commitments in Washington County than any other county in Oregon, but the standard for civil commitment is so high. That's part of the problem. And so instead of trying to get people who really can't help themselves into a safe environment, jail becomes what I guess law enforcement people feel is a better alternative. I don't feel that it's a place for people who are ill. I think hospitals are a place for people who are ill.
There's a backstory here about the Oregon State Hospital that we've just built a new $600 million hospital in Salem and another $400 million hospital in Junction City. And already there's a backlog of people in hospitals and in jails waiting to go to this state hospital. I talked to the head of mental health at Legacy Hospital a week ago, and she said she had 45 people waiting in her hospitals to go to the state hospital. These are waiting in the emergency room.
Wow.
Day after day, and some of them had been there for 10, 15 days waiting to go to the state hospital.
Oh, and actually, didn't the Department of Justice actually do the same kind of investigation to our state mental health system? And I still don't know what the agreement is and how that's playing out.
That conversation is all behind closed doors. There's no settlement agreement, and we know very little about what's going on there. And certainly there's been very little progress from the point of view of the family member.
Well, let me just say, I'm so sorry to hear that that's your experience, because it's not right. People should be able to get the service they need when they need it at a cost they can afford without putting your family members at risk by calling 911.
I read something recently that asking a mentally ill person, and I would add their families, to use the present system is like asking a paraplegic to use the stairs. It's just not there. And historically, the system may have been bad, but the system now is non-existent.
Well, thank you for sharing your story.
Sure.
I'm so sorry for your experience, but I really appreciate you sharing it and giving Jason an opportunity to just affirm that this is worse. And actually gave me another idea, because I want to find out. I got to find somebody at the state to tell me what's happening with the settlement around our mental health services in the state of Oregon. So thank you so much for your call.
Sure. Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
503-231-8187. We're minus on minutes. Great advice to give people the numbers to call. So good news, bad news. The good news is that there are some numbers to call, and there's some limited help for people who are in distress right now. But as we've heard clearly from this last caller, that it depends on what part of the state you live in, and what services are available. My understanding is Washington County has probably the least amount of social services of any of the surrounding counties for people who are trying to access social service systems.
Yeah, and it gets worse as you get farther away from Portland. Really, in Wallowa County and Coos County and Klamath County, the services are non-existent, and people really, as if you had diabetes or COPD and there was no medical treatment at all. These people die young.
Right.
And they leave their families in misery, and it's entirely the responsibility of the Oregon State Legislature to repair this. They have failed. Session after session.
Session after session. Well, you know, I guess they're consistent. They continue to fail the houseless community, the mental health community, and they're in Salem now trying to figure out what the state dog should be. Back to the phone line. Hello, Joe. We can squeak you in if you can be 1 minute or less. Hi there.
Yes, I'd like people to go to KBOO's website, and there's actually three radio shows that they should listen to in the archives. The first and foremost is Madness Radio, which is on some Mondays at 11 or sometimes 11:30.
Will Hall.
Most time it's on 11:30 for half an hour, Madness Radio. And then also check out on Sunday mornings at 8:30, Pathways, which deals with not only mental health but meditation, overall health and stuff. And then also listen to Health Watch with Dr. David Neiman, which is on most Monday mornings at 11 a.m.
Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, it's really suspicious to me when I talked to you a couple of years ago here on the air, and you said that the Portland Police union contract...
I'm sorry, sir.
It left out steroids.
Oh,
it
right.
It left out steroids.
Good yes.
Point. And I think that's part of this aggression, that these cops are overly aggressive.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry, sir. I'm going to have to cut you off on that note. We are out of time. It's amazing how quickly an hour goes. I want to let you know that getting up and standing up for your rights is going to be happening at the Melody Ballroom Saturday, February 6th. Reggae Bob would love to see you there. Thank you very much, Jason.
Thanks,
Jordan. Thank you, Steve. It's been a great morning. See you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a fabulous day.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold. After story and never been.
And good morning. You are listening to the Mighty Boo, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. A minute before 9 o'clock, and we're about a half hour away from kicking off the Fight the Empire with Per Fogering, looking at how the U.S. Empire paved the way for Islamic State. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre will be hosting Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder. And on today's show, Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, discusses his trip to Palestine. And Todd Pierce, a retired Army attorney, talks about American militarism and how military rule has caused the degeneration of principles within the U.S. Constitution. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Lisa Loving speaks with writer Alifair Burke, about her new suspense novel, The X. And then at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Rosemary Reed Miller discusses her book, Threads of Time, The Fabric of History, which profiles African-American dressmakers and designers from 1850 to the present. That is all coming up this morning, right after Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. Stick around, that's next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the book release for Radical Mycology, a book on DIY mushroom cultivation, pollution cleanup,